The Principles of Economics, Lecture 7. The International Monetary System, Exchange Rates, and Trade Deficits.
Hi, I'm Peter Navarro, and welcome to Lecture 7. This will be our last lecture in our macroeconomics sequence. In this lecture, we're going to talk about the international monetary system and the all-important topic of trade deficits. In order to understand these topics, we must necessarily begin with a discussion of so-called exchange rates. An exchange rate is simply the rate at which one nation's currency can be traded for another nation's currency. In fact, such exchange rates can fluctuate rather markedly. For example, shortly after the euro was introduced as the official currency of Europe in 2002, 1 euro only cost 80 cents of an American dollar to buy. By 2005, however, the euro had strengthened so much that it cost an American almost $1.50 to buy 1 euro. In practical terms, that means that if you were an American on vacation in Europe in 2005, that vacation would have cost you almost twice as much as it would have just a few years earlier. As to why exchange rates rise and fall between countries, there are three basic reasons. The first has to do with different rates of growth across countries. If, for example, the U.S. gross domestic product is growing faster than the Japanese GDP, the U.S. dollar will depreciate relative to the Japanese yen. This happens because U.S. consumers simply have more money to spend on imported Japanese goods than the Japanese consumers, stuck in a more sluggish economy, have to spend on American imports. The result is that a surplus of dollars builds up relative to the yen, and through the laws of supply and demand, the dollar's value declines. Exchange rates can also change with a change in relative interest rates. For example, when U.S. interest rates rise relative to, say, British interest rates, the dollar will appreciate relative to the British pound. This is because higher U.S. interest rates will attract relatively more British investment. But in order to invest in America, the British must first buy dollars with their pounds. This drives the value of the dollar up relative to the pound, and as we shall see, this interest rate effect has played a key role in driving U.S. trade deficits. Now, the third reason why exchange rates shift is due to different rates of inflation. If, for example, the rate of inflation in Canada is higher than in Europe, the Canadian dollar will depreciate relative to the euro. This is because exchange rates in the currency markets reflect real price differences in the goods markets. Thus, if inflation raises the actual or nominal price of, say, an auto made in Canada, relative to the nominal price of an identical auto made in Europe, there must be a corresponding adjustment in the exchange rate so that the real inflation-adjusted prices of the two autos stays the same. Economists, by the way, call this the law of one price. And in our discussion of the structure of the international monetary system, I'm going to show you how differing rates of inflation played a key role in the downfall of the so-called gold standard, a linchpin of the international monetary system for over 60 years. To begin that discussion, allow me to first note that in the examples I've been giving you about the euro and the dollar and the pound, I've assumed what is called a floating exchange rate. A floating exchange rate system is one in which the exchange rates of currencies, like the pound and the dollar and euro, are allowed to float freely and be determined by market forces. But please note this, not all countries in the international monetary system allow their exchange rates to be determined in such a flexible or floating exchange rate system. In fact, some countries use what is called a fixed exchange rate system, in which governments determine the rates at which currencies are exchanged and then make the necessary adjustments in their economies to ensure that these rates continue. To better understand these two major types of exchange rate systems, let's take another trip through time and see how each of the two systems developed. In doing so, we will see that today's international monetary system is actually a hybrid of purely flexible versus purely fixed exchange rates, a hybrid known as the managed float system. Between 1867 and 1933, except for the period around World War I, most of the nations of the world were on the gold standard. Under this fixed exchange rate system, the currency issued by each country had to either be gold or redeemable in gold. And once a country agreed to be on the gold standard, its currency was convertible into a fixed amount of gold. With these fixed exchange rates, if a nation ran a trade deficit, it would be required to use its gold reserves to buy currency to prevent the value of its currency from falling. In contrast, if a nation ran a trade surplus, it would accumulate gold. Now, you might wonder why the gold standard was so popular. The answer lies in something called, perhaps rather strangely, the gold specie flow mechanism. This monetary adjustment mechanism was first described by Scottish philosopher and economist David Hume in 1752. Let me illustrate this gold specie flow mechanism and how it is supposed to eliminate any trade deficits with a very simple example. Suppose then that both Britain and the U.S. start with an equal amount of gold reserves and begin trading. At first, the U.S. initially runs a trade deficit so that it has to ship some of its gold to Britain. Of course, if the U.S. continues to run such a deficit, it will eventually run out of gold. However, before that can happen, Hume's multi-pronged gold specie flow adjustment mechanism will begin to bring trade flows back into balance. So how does it work? Well, first, the U.S. money supply is reduced by its loss of gold. This causes the U.S. price level to fall by the quantity theory of money that we previously learned about. That is, a fall in the money supply must lead to a fall in price. Intuitively, this happens because with less money around, people can't bid as much for goods. Now, at the same time the U.S. money supply is decreasing, the British money supply is increasing and British prices are rising. So here's a question to test your economic intuition. If American prices are falling and British prices are rising, what is going to happen to the trade flows between the two countries and the size of the U.S. deficit? Here's the answer, and it entails four specific adjustments. First, America will decrease its imports of British and other foreign goods, which have become relatively expensive. Second, America's exports will increase because America's domestically produced goods have become relatively inexpensive on world markets. Third, British consumers will import more of America's now more relatively inexpensive goods. And fourth, British exports will decline because British exports have become more expensive. Of course, the net effect of this gold specie flow trade adjustment is that a balance of payments equilibrium is restored in both Britain and the U.S., just exactly as David Hume predicted. Now, it is a matter of some debate as to whether Hume's mechanism actually works. But what is true is that the world's fixed exchange rate system based on the gold standard worked reasonably well at stabilizing the currency markets right up until World War I. However, with the advent of the war, many nations had to temporarily abandon the gold standard to finance their war efforts. This led to inflation, and in particular, it led to differing rates of inflation in different countries. As I explained earlier, these differing rates of inflation distort the relative value of currencies. Thus, when peace returned after World War I and nations returned to the gold standard, the old exchange rates no longer reflected the true value of the different currencies. For example, the French franc was significantly undervalued. As a result, upon its return to the gold standard, the French economy enjoyed an export-led boom, and France began to accumulate large surpluses of foreign currencies. In contrast, Britain had sustained lower inflation rates than many of its trading partners, so its currency was overvalued. As a result, Britain found it difficult to sell its exports and found itself overwhelmed by cheap imports. In fact, by 1930, Britain was so drained of its gold reserves that it had to abandon the gold standard. At that point, the U.S. dollar came under similar attack. France, in particular, began to unload large amounts of its surplus dollars for U.S. gold. While the presidential administration of Herbert Hoover in the U.S. first stemmed this gold flow by raising domestic interest rates, this act of contractionary monetary policy also helped push, indeed, some would say helped shove, the U.S. further into the Great Depression. Eventually, in 1933, President Roosevelt followed the British in abandoning the gold standard. With the collapse of the gold standard in the 1930s, countries desperate to create jobs in a depressionary global economy engaged in so-called competitive devaluations. In particular, they began to devalue their currencies in order to boost exports and reduce imports. However, these competitive devaluations acted, in effect, like a beggar-thy-neighbor trade policy. Jobs created in one country led to job losses in other countries. These economic pressures, in turn, contributed to growing political pressures that eventually led to World War II. It was the harsh lessons of the 1930s that brought the Allied powers to Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, in 1944, as representatives from 44 countries met for 22 days to design a new international monetary system. The new system featured a modified fixed exchange rate system called a partially fixed or adjustable peg system. This system replaced the gold standard with a U.S. dollar standard, and the U.S. dollar was designated as the world's key currency. Thereafter, most international trade and finance was to be transacted in dollars, and fixed exchange rate parities for all currencies were set in both gold and dollar terms. For example, the parity of the British pound was set at 12.5 per ounce of gold. Given that the gold price of the dollar was $35 per ounce, this implied an official exchange rate between the dollar and the pound of $35 to 12.5 pounds, or $2.80 for 1 pound. Note, however, that while the Bretton Woods Agreement remained wedded to the concept of fixed exchange rates, there was one very important difference. Bretton Woods also provided for a cooperative mechanism in which the exchange rates were only partially fixed. These new partially fixed rates could be periodically adjusted to reflect changes in currency values in a process known as adjusting the peg. The idea of this new partially fixed or adjustable peg exchange rate system was to provide both the stability of the gold standard's fixed rates with the adaptability of flexible exchange rates. Through this adaptability, relative price changes across nations could be addressed through periodic and cooperative adjustments in exchange rates rather than through the painful deflations and recessions that had plagued the gold standard. For the first decade of its existence, the Bretton Woods system was a great success. Under the Marshall Plan created in 1947, the U.S. lent large sums of dollars to Europe for its rebuilding, and these dollars flowed right back into the U.S. for the purchase of machinery, equipment, and consumer goods. However, by the mid-1950s, the European economies had become increasingly self-sufficient. As U.S. exports to Europe slowed, America's strong economy continued to attract foreign imports. At the same time, U.S. trade deficits were further fueled by an overvalued currency, budget deficits to finance the Vietnam War, and growing overseas investment by American firms. By the 1960s, with the U.S. trade deficit mounting, a huge surplus of dollars began to pile up in foreign banks. As speculative concerns increased that the U.S. would devalue the dollar, many foreign governments began to redeem their surplus dollars for U.S. gold. as U.S. gold reserves fell dramatically, the U.S. government tried unsuccessfully to pressure these foreign governments into retaining their surplus dollars. A surplus, by the way, that had grown from virtually nothing in 1945 to $50 billion by the early 1970s. Finally, in August of 1971, a very reluctant Nixon administration abandoned the dollar standard and Bretton Woods. No longer would dollars be redeemable for gold at $35 an ounce. And in the wake of that abandonment, the dollar's value fell precipitously. Now, fast forward to today. Unlike the earlier uniform systems of first the gold standard and then Bretton Woods, today's exchange rate system fits into no tidy mold. Without anyone's having planned it, the world has moved to a hybrid system known as the managed float. It has these major features. First, a few countries like the United States have a primarily flexible or floating exchange rate. In this approach, markets determine the currency's value, and there is very little intervention. Second, other major countries, such as Canada, Japan, and more recently Britain, have managed but flexible exchange rates. Under this system, a country will buy or sell its currency to reduce the day-to-day volatility of currency fluctuations. A country may also engage in systematic intervention to move its currency towards what it believes to be a more appropriate level. Third, some countries join together in a currency block in order to stabilize exchange rates among themselves while allowing their currencies to move flexibly relative to those of the rest of the world. The most important of these blocks is the European monetary system, which has adopted that single currency we call the euro. Fourth, many countries use a variation on the old fixed exchange rate system by pegging their currencies to a major currency such as the dollar or to a basket of currencies. Sometimes this peg is allowed to glide smoothly upward or downward in a system known as a gliding or crawling peg. Other times it is tightly fixed. And I should note here that perhaps the most important of the countries adopting this kind of fixed exchange rate system is that of China. It pegs its currency, the renminbi, to the dollar, and this fixed peg has actually created a lot of trade friction between the U.S. and China. Why is this so? Well, this is because even as the U.S. has run larger and larger deficits with China, the dollar has been unable to weaken relative to the Chinese renminbi and bring about the kind of trade flow adjustments envisioned by David Hume's gold specie flow adjustment mechanism hundreds of years ago. The result, at least in the eyes of some American politicians, is a loss of American jobs to China. Now, as our final topic about exchange rates, I need to briefly mention the idea of exchange rate intervention. As a practical matter, almost all countries tend to intervene in the currency markets, either when markets become disorderly or when exchange rates seem far out of line with existing price levels and trade flows. Such government exchange rate intervention occurs when the government buys or sells its own or foreign currencies to affect exchange rates. For example, the Japanese government on any given day might buy $1 billion worth of Japanese yen with U.S. dollars. This would cause a rise or an appreciation of the yen. In general, a government intervenes when it believes its foreign exchange rate is out of line with its currency's fundamental value. An excellent historical example of such intervention on a very broad scale is offered by the actions of the so-called Group of Seven Nations way back in 1987. This group at the time was the U.S., Germany, Japan, Britain, France, Italy, and Canada. And these nations all agreed to stabilize the value of the dollar relative to the other countries' currencies. The problem was that during the previous 2 years, the dollar had declined rapidly because of large U.S. trade deficits. And these G7 nations, other than the U.S., were worried that any further weakening of the dollar would stifle their exports and more broadly disrupt economic growth. So, these nations agreed to purchase large amounts of dollars to boost the dollar's value. In fact, this intervention worked very well to stabilize the dollar. Now, at this point in the lecture, there is something that might be bothering you. After all, if the U.S. uses a flexible exchange rate system, how is it that it can keep running large trade deficits year after year? Indeed, in most cases, under such a system, there should be a natural adjustment of the U.S. balance of payments due to the forces of supply and demand. In particular, these large U.S. trade deficits should lead to a surplus of dollars in foreign exchange markets and drive down the price of the dollar. This, in turn, should lower the price of the country's exports, increase the price of its imports, and restore balance to U.S. trade flows. But such an adjustment process, quite similar to Hume's gold specie flow adjustment mechanism, has not worked particularly well in curbing the chronic trade deficits of the United States. The question is why, and the answer lies in first understanding the nature of the U.S. trade deficit. The first problem may be traced to the large chronic budget deficits that the U.S. began to run in the 1980s. The need for the government to finance these budget deficits drove up interest rates as the U.S. Treasury Department had to offer interest rates high enough to woo foreign investors. But this strengthened the dollar as foreigners had to first buy dollars in order to buy U.S. bonds. The result is that a stronger dollar made exports more expensive and imports cheaper and sent the trade deficit spiraling upward. After the turn of this new century, the same dynamic has been at work, but in a more subtle way. In particular, the U.S. has continued to run large budget deficits, and even though the dollar weakened, it didn't weaken as fast as it might otherwise have because of the willingness of foreign countries like China and Japan to keep buying U.S. bonds, in effect subsidizing the American consumption of exports. It's not just budget deficits that contribute to America's chronic trade deficits. A declining savings rate in the U.S. has also been a major contributing factor to the trade deficit problem in this sense. As the U.S. savings rate has fallen, the investment rate has remained fairly stable or even increased. This has been possible because foreign investment has filled the savings investment gap. One result is that U.S. citizens have been able to save less while consuming more, and at least part of that increased consumption has been on imported goods. In this sense, the U.S. capital surplus may not only result from the trade deficit, but also help cause it. Still, a third reason for the U.S.'s persistent trade deficit is that over the last 20 years, the U.S. economy has grown at a faster pace than either Europe or Japan, as well as many of its major trading partners. This growth in U.S. income has boosted import consumption, even as recessions or stagnation in countries like Japan and Canada have depressed their purchases of U.S. exports. Perhaps what is most interesting about these three major causes of the U.S. trade deficit is that they are all driven in some degree by arguably irresponsible U.S. domestic fiscal and monetary policies. That's why, to end this lecture, I want to talk a little bit about how the conduct of domestic fiscal and monetary policies in a global economy can affect not only the domestic country's trade balance. Such conduct, good, bad, or ugly, can also significantly affect the rates of growth and unemployment in the domestic country's trading partners. And here's the punchline. Any imbalances in either capital or trade flows in one country will affect all trading partners. This means, for example, that the U.S. trade deficits and capital surpluses are not just domestic headaches, they are global problems as well. Perhaps the best way to understand this important point is to illustrate the mechanisms through which domestic fiscal and monetary policies actually affect the global economy. By doing so, we can tie together many of the lessons we've learned in earlier lectures. So let's look at fiscal policy first. Suppose then that America's GDP falls. This might happen as a result of contractionary fiscal policy to slow inflation, or it may simply be that demand in the private sector is weak. Regardless of the reason, the result will be the same. Lower income in America will lead to lower imports from Europe. And the flip side of this coin, of course, is that as European exports to the U.S. falls, so too does European income. In other words, America's domestic fiscal policy can not only lead to a contraction in the American economy, it can also function as a contractionary fiscal policy for Europe as well. By the way, economists refer to this chain of causality as the multiplier link. And from this multiplier link, you can perhaps see why it has grown increasingly important for countries to coordinate their fiscal policies. For example, suppose that America wants to reduce its trade deficit with Japan. Based on our discussions thus far, one way to do this might be for the U.S. to adopt a more contractionary fiscal policy. However, such a policy might not be politically acceptable on the home front if the U.S. economy is in recession. Alternatively, however, the U.S. might encourage Japan to adopt a more expansionary fiscal policy as a way of stimulating Japanese demand for U.S. imports and strengthening the yen relative to the dollar. In fact, this is precisely the kind of request that an American president might make to the Japanese prime minister at a bilateral trade summit. And such a coordinated macroeconomic approach can work, but only if each country benefits. For example, if Japan is in a recession with low inflation, it may well agree to the fiscal expansion. However, if Japan is at or near full employment, it may simply refuse any fiscal stimulus for fear of igniting inflation. Such difficulties in coordinating macroeconomic policies can be further highlighted by a second example, which will shed light on the impacts of domestic monetary policy on the global economy. In this example, let's consider what happens in Europe when America raises its interest rates through contractionary monetary policy. What do you think will happen? Well, as America's interest rates rise, investors will sell European financial assets to buy American financial assets so they can get a higher return on their investment. Of course, this will lead to an appreciation of the dollar and a collateral depreciation of the euro. This, in turn, will increase Europe's net exports and thereby raise European output and income and stimulate its economy. Note, however, there is an important offsetting effect. In particular, higher interest rates in America will tend to raise European interest rates. These higher rates, in turn, will tend to depress domestic investment in Europe and thereby lower Europe's output and employment. In other words, in its attempt to fight domestic inflation by raising U.S. interest rates, the Federal Reserve of the United States may well increase the chance that Europe will experience a recession. Economists refer to this chain of events as the monetary link. And here's an important point regarding this link. Unlike with fiscal policy and the multiplier link, the overall impact of monetary policy and the monetary link on domestic GDP is ambiguous and will depend on the particular situation. However, what should be unambiguous from our example is the critical importance of globally coordinating not just fiscal policy, but monetary policy as well. To end this lecture, let me reinforce this very important point with a very interesting real-world historical example about the difficulties of achieving the coordination of fiscal and monetary policies across countries. Again, it's time machine time. So let's go back to the late 1970s, just after the aftermath of the demise of Bretton Woods and the dollar standard. At this point in time, the nations of Europe have established a fixed exchange rate system pegged to the German mark. These nations have done so in the hopes of avoiding a repeat of the competitive devaluations and economic disruptions that had plagued Europe in the 1930s after the collapse of the gold standard. In fact, this European monetary system would work reasonably well over the next decade. Note, however, that in 1990, the reunification of Germany resulted in large budget deficits as West Germany was forced to subsidize the far less efficient and struggling East German industrial base. To cope with the resultant inflationary pressures, the Bundesbank, the German equivalent of the Federal Reserve, significantly raised interest rates. In this case, German monetary policy was clearly uncoordinated with that of its neighbors. That is, German monetary policy was being used simply for domestic macroeconomic management to cope with inflation, without regard to the impact of these rising interest rates on Germany's trading partners. The results, however, were severe. Faced with rising German interest rates, other European countries in the European monetary system had to raise their interest rates to prevent their own currencies from depreciating against the German mark and moving outside the prescribed range of parities. These interest rate increases, along with a worldwide recession, pushed the European countries outside of Germany into an ever-deepening recession. Eventually, this particular version of the European monetary system was brought down by speculators who believed that the beleaguered countries would not continue to tolerate unrealistic exchange rates and high interest rates. One by one, currencies came under attack. The Finnish mark, the Swedish crown, the Italian lira, the British pound, the Spanish peseta, and the system collapsed. The macroeconomic lesson of this crisis is that a country cannot simultaneously have fixed exchange rates, open capital markets, and an independent monetary policy. In the wake of this crisis, the major European countries resolved this dilemma by moving to a common currency, that's the euro. It was a step that strongly reinforces the importance of coordinating global macro policies. Well, that concludes our discussion of the major macroeconomic issues. In the next set of lectures, 8 through 14, we are going to go small as we learn about microeconomics. Microeconomics covers such important issues as how prices and wages are set, and why, in a free market system, the government sometimes sees fit to regulate our markets. And just as with the first 7 lectures in this series, you will see that there are really some big ideas associated with the study of this more micro side of the economics coin. So do what you can to complete the questions in your review guide, and when you are ready to move on, we'll be talking in Lecture 8. I'm Peter Navarro from the University of California, Irvine.
After listening to Lecture 7, a student posed this question to Professor Navarro. Is it better for a country like the U.S. to have a weak or a strong currency? Let's listen to the professor's response.
Both a weak and a strong currency have their advantages. With a weak currency, a country is able to sell its exports and thereby create jobs through an export-led expansion, and that's a good thing. However, a weak currency also breeds domestic inflation because when you try to buy goods outside the country, things like Japanese or Chinese imports, that creates inflation. So a strong currency is a good cure for inflation, but a weak currency is a good cure for selling exports.
Another student then posed this question to Professor Navarro. When are trade wars most likely to happen?
Trade wars are most likely to happen when the global economy begins to sink into a recession. When that happens, individual countries will try to use their own domestic fiscal and monetary policies to stimulate jobs and employment, but this can exacerbate the relationships of the various currencies across countries, and that in turn can create trade frictions. A good example in the early part of this new millennium happened between the U.S. and China. China refused to revalue its currency upward because it wanted to create a lot of new jobs for its peasant population moving into the cities. And meanwhile, America lost a lot of jobs because of that, and that created a lot of trade frictions.
Finally, a student wondered, will the world eventually move to one currency?
Maybe in 100 years or so. That might be a good goal to work towards, but it's not going to be in our lifetime. However, what you might well see is an Asian currency, like we now see in Europe, where countries like Japan and Korea and China get together and have one currency to work with the euro. And then maybe in America, we might see Canadians and the U.S. and Latin American countries band together. These are good ideas on the one hand, but they also create a lot of problems on the other hand. So let's see how the future unfolds.
This ends Lecture 7.